This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, sitting in for Terry Gross. Today's first guest, Barbara Cook, has had two illustrious careers. The first was when she starred on Broadway in the original productions of Candide, The Music Man, and She Loves Me. Then, after a period of alcoholism and food addiction, she returned to the stage in the late 1970s, but this time as a cabaret singer, one of the best, singing a wide range of songs from the American Popular Songbook. Now, at the age of 88, she's still singing, and she has a new memoir called Then and Now. She writes about her career and her life off stage, in which she's faced many challenges, starting when she was 3, when her mother wrongly blamed her for the death of her 18-month-old sister, who died of double pneumonia. Let's start with one of the Broadway songs she originated, Till There Was You. This is from the 1957 cast recording of The Music Man. She won a Tony for her performance in that production.
There were bells on the hill, but I never heard them ringing. No, I never heard them at all till there was you.
Barbara Cook, welcome to Fresh Air.
Well, thank you very much.
You grew up in the Atlanta area. You were born in 1927. Your early years were during the Depression. Broadway must have seemed very far away. Would you describe your living conditions after your father left when you and your mother moved in other women of the family?
It was not a very good time. My mother and I moved into my grandmother's house, her mother, with several of her sisters, and it was a pretty crowded house. There were 3 rooms, and my mother and I slept in the middle room with my grandmother and one of her daughters. The other 2 daughters slept in the living room, and then the 3rd room in the back was a kitchen where my grandmother cooked wonderful meals. The food was always so good.
I found myself getting angry with your mother as I read your book, but then I had to pull back and say your mother might have been mentally ill and undiagnosed.
Well, that never occurred to me during that time. And, I think that's because people didn't talk about that then, you know. We didn't know that much about mental illness. And I don't want to paint this with too strong a brush. I think she had something called... what is it called? Borderline personality disorder. I've spoken with a therapist who has corroborated my idea. And she was a good lady in lots of ways, but she didn't have any idea that she was hurting me sometimes in the things that she would say.
Well, she basically blamed you for the death of your younger sister. Your younger sister was 18 months when she died. You were 3 years
yep.
old. And explain what happened.
Well, my sister, Pat, had pneumonia. And then I got pneumonia and gave her, and I also got whooping cough. And I gave her whooping cough on top of the pneumonia that she had. Now, my very first therapist said something that was so smart. He said, did it ever occur to you that she caught it, that you didn't give it to her? She caught it. And that really helped, you know, because I grew up thinking I was responsible for my sister's death.
Because your mother told you that you were, so that must have really been imprinted on your brain.
Well, it was. And I shouldn't say partially, in a way, it still is, you know, so I sometimes think I don't deserve some of the nice things that have happened for me.
I just want to mention your mother also blamed you for your father leaving because after your younger sister died, the marriage broke up.
Well, you know, she said if my sister hadn't died, he wouldn't have left. Mm-hmm. He wouldn't have gone. And I believed I was responsible for her dying. So then I became responsible for his leaving as well.
Yeah, it's a big burden to carry around. How old were you when you started singing? And what did you sing when you were very young?
Darling, I always sang. My earliest memories are of singing. And I used to sing from, what the hell is that movie? Wishing will make it so. What is that song? Just keep on wishing and cares will go. Something like that.
So early in your career, and I guess you're in your late teens or early 20s at this point, you meet the composer Vernon Duke. He loved your voice. He had you sing at backers' auditions. Then he told you to audition to perform at Tamament, a resort hotel in the Pennsylvania Poconos. You got the gig, and there you met Jerry Bock, who with Sheldon Harnick later wrote She Loves Me, which you starred in. They also wrote Fiorello and Fiddler on the Roof. In your second season at this resort hotel, you met the man who became your husband and the father of your son. So through the help of Vernon Duke, you were launched into this new world, then the world that became your home, the world of performing. What was it like for you to make the transition into that world?
Well, it was scary because I saw a lot of these people performing before I joined them. And I thought they were all gods, you know, theater gods. And when I saw them, I didn't really enjoy the show because I was sitting there being so nervous, thinking about, oh, my God, am I really going to be able to get up there on stage with those people? So it made me so nervous because I was so afraid. God, am I ever really going to be able to do that?
Did anxiety continue with you through your stage career?
Well, yes, I'm pretty much over it now since I'm doing what I want to do, you know. What I mean by that is I choose the songs and I do the songs the way I think they ought to be done. Yeah, I've always been a kind of nervous Nelly kind of person, yeah.
So let's talk about one of your early musicals, Candide, with music by Leonard Bernstein.
And oh, God.
One of the piece you became famous for in this was Glitter and Be Gay, which is a very showy, operatic song. What function does the song serve in the musical? Just in terms of being that kind of ornate, with all these like high notes and you know, kind of trilling.
Well, it was and is very difficult, and a lot of singers do sing it now, but not always very well. I think, particularly the spoken part is overdone. I think far too often. It's a very delightful, funny song, and what they do is try to make it more delightful and more funny, and it just gets silly sometimes. People sound like they're losing their minds when they do this. Ah, it's nuts. I don't know why they do that. And they, you know, I was lucky because I was right there when the song was being introduced. I know personally what Lenny Bernstein wanted it to sound like. Certain things that are difficult to do. The ha-ha-ha's in there, he wanted to really be like separate notes, and so that each one is a little push. And then you have to be sure to really sing very lyrically after that to get you out of the pushing, because pushing ain't no good in singing, you see?
But right, and this is a part, like, excuse me for, I was going to demonstrate, but that's ludicrous. Can you just, like, demonstrate what the sound is? In a lower note of the pushing haws?
Well, for instance, it's written ba 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 ba, right? Those are the notes.
Mm-hmm.
And many people do it like a run, you know, da da dee da, da, connecting all the things. But that's not what he wanted. He wanted each one to be a separate ha, so it really sounds like laughter. He wanted it to be ha 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 ha. It's hard to do, and most people don't do that. They do make it like a run or something.
So how did you protect your voice? Because even your vocal coach told you that the ha. Why is the ha bad? It forces the vocal cords together.
Well, it's not good to push. Mm-hmm. And he said if you in the ensuing phrases, if you sing very lyrically, very carefully and smoothly, that you heal yourself instantly. So you don't have to worry about those ha-ha-has. Do what he wants and then sing very lyrically.
I think we should hear a little bit of this. This is an incredible performance by my guest Barbara Cook from the musical Candide. And this was recorded in 1956. So here's Barbara Cook.
Born to higher things, did I droop my wings? Singing of a song, nothing can assuage. And yet, of course, I'd rather like to revel.
I think it was like a year after Candide, you did The Music Man, and in that you originated the song Till There Was You, and a beautiful song called My White Knight. And then you went on to do She Loves Me a few years after that. Sometime, I guess it was a few years maybe, after She Loves Me, you basically stopped doing Broadway and went through this really bad period of your life where you became addicted to alcohol and food. But then you managed to get sober, and you had a second career that I'm really grateful for, because I just really love your interpretations of songs. And your voice changed, too. I mean, your voice deepened. And
sure.
And even you say in your book that there was this, like, emotional depth that you found in songs that you feel you didn't quite get to in the same way on stage in musicals. And I want to play... I don't know, this is what I particularly love this performance, and it's you singing We'll Be Together Again.
Oh.
And I just want to play this so people hear how you sounded in 1998 when you made this, with your longtime accompanist and music director, the late Wally Harper, accompanying you at the piano. So let's listen to Barbara Cook in 1998 singing We'll Be Together Again.
No fears, no tears. Remember, there's always tomorrow. So what if we have to part? We'll be together again. Your kiss, your smile, our memories
times when I know you'll be sad. Don't let temptation surround you. Don't let the blues make you bad.
That's nice. I like it.
No, it's so beautiful. There's just such depth in that performance. And
thank you.
Your accompanist on that version of We'll Be Together Again was Wally Harper. And yeah, he helped open the door to a whole new performing identity for you. He led you into the cabaret world and became your music director and accompanist for and good friend for about 30 years. Yeah.
Well, I had done cabaret. The first work I did in New York was cabaret at a little place called the Blue Angel. And then there was a long time when I was out of work and was having problems with weight and alcohol and everything else. And he really helped me get this second career, if you will. He helped me get that going. Very generous man and a good person in lots of ways.
So Wally Harper died in 2004 at the age of 63, and Wally Harper was gay. Many of the people you've known from cabaret and Broadway are or were gay. Your son came out to you when he was an adult, and you write that you wept for days after that.
And yeah, I did for 5 days.
Why? Since you knew so many gay people, it's not like you were homophobic.
Not at all, but it was... Well, this is a huge thing about somebody, you know, it's a big thing. And I thought I knew my son thoroughly, and then I realized that I didn't. You know, that he had this whole way of life that he wanted to join, if he hadn't already. And I didn't realize that. And I thought, there's something wrong. I have a son I don't know. And I cried for about 5 days, and I also thought, am I going to have grandchildren? All of that. And then it occurred to me to ask myself, what the hell's going on with you? And I realized that all my life I had felt outside of the, well, I call it the mainstream of life. And by having a son, that plugged me in somehow in my mind. And then, when he told me he was gay, that unplugged me, and that disturbed me. And then I thought, wait a minute, what's going on? And I said to myself, look, Adam LeGrand is not here to plug me into anything, and I am here to try to help him to be the fullest person that I know how to help him be. And then I was okay. But I really had a week of just crying like crazy.
You know how you were saying that you realized that the job of your son wasn't to keep you plugged in? Your job was to help him? That sounds like it was an important revelation, because when you were younger, you write that your mother couldn't differentiate between you and her. She really saw you as an extension of herself. And that when your father left when you were young, your mother had you sleep in her bed, and that you slept in her bed until you were 20. When you moved New York to work on Broadway and to work in clubs, your mother was just like bereft, and she eventually came to New York to live near you. And it sounds like, you know, I know you loved your mother very much, but she was also perhaps mentally ill, and I think her attitude toward you must have really been a burden. If she relied on you to be her, or to be her extension into the world.
Well, I think so. Yeah. There was absolutely no divide between us as far as she was concerned. And that can be difficult.
How is your health now? You're 88 now.
Yeah, I'm okay. I weigh too much, of course. But I'm all right.
So you get around in a wheelchair now.
I do. I can't walk. I have some kind of, I think it's called, wait a minute, PMR. Polymyalgia rheumatica, not rheumatica, Barbara, rheumatica. I don't know. I guess you have to do something about that. Polymyalgia rheumatica, that's it.
I was actually surprised reading your book at your generous use of expletives in some places. For some reason, because you're like the ingenue in the Broadway shows that I know, I didn't expect you to know words. Like, isn't that ridiculous that I would think that?
Yeah, it is. Unfortunately, I do very well with those words.
So when you perform, do you still have stage anxiety?
I do sometimes if it's a big deal. Like Carnegie Hall, I stand in the wings, and I worry a bit. But there's something I do when that happens that helps me a little bit. When I'm standing in the wings waiting to go on, I kind of plant my feet and feel a kind of strength coming up from the ground into me. And then I think about giving back this gift that I have been given. And when I do that, then I get out of ego so much. And then I don't worry so much about what people think about how I sing or how I look. And I just try to sing more deeply and more personally. And I really enjoy that. I love singing. I do. I get rid of so much stuff by singing. It's a wonderful thing to be able to do.
Barbara Cook, thank you so much for talking with us.
Darling, thank you very much.
Barbara Cook's new memoir is called Then and Now. She spoke with Terry last Monday. The expression the vanishing middle class has a lot of meaning for people like Matt Johnson, who grew up on the sinking side of the income imbalance. He's going to tell us about that in a personal essay he's written about watching his mother try to keep from getting deeper in debt. He last joined us on Fresh Air to talk about his semi-autobiographical novel, Loving Day.
When it was hot, the bill my mother wouldn't pay was the gas one. This meant peanut butter sandwiches for breakfast, peanut butter sandwiches for lunch, and also dinner peanut butter sandwiches or fruit or anything else good that didn't have to be cooked or refrigerated. In the colder months, her neglected bill of choice was the electric, which meant reverting to an agrarian sleeping schedule, up at dawn, down at sunset, and candlelight, despite the fact that the largest city of Philadelphia glowed alive outside our window. In the apartments where we had electric heat, we warmed ourselves by turning the oven up high and leaving its door hang open. My mom's fingers held wide to catch its heat like it was a campfire. The phone being turned off was my favorite because it just meant more conversation and walks to the payphone two blocks away for essentials. These periods would last weeks or hours, whatever it took to get to her next payday. My mom couldn't pay the bills on time during this period because she was generally broke, a full-time college student, also working a full-time clerical job, all while being a full-time mother as well. Without sufficient funds, some months she had to choose which bill could get paid, which bill could get paid late, which bill couldn't get paid that month at all. But eventually, whatever was turned off would be turned on again. After paying the original balance, plus the late fee, plus the reconnection fee, plus sometimes having to lose a day of work and pay to stay home for the technician to eventually show up and bring us back into the modern age. On top of the existing cost of her keeping her house a home, which she already could barely afford, my mom paid the poverty tax. And that informal poverty tax wasn't just on utilities. It was there in her bank account, where $45 overdraft charges could accumulate into hundreds in a day. It was there in the high interest rate when she bought a car and finally bought a home, rates that may have also been higher because her blackness was factored into her loan. She wasn't just struggling with poverty. She was also struggling with effectively being fined for being poor. And what together became a societal mechanism to keep her poor as well. The three words, vanishing middle class, are a popular way of describing America's increasing income inequality, our slow but steady move to a polar society of haves and have-nots. But in my head, it's a sterile, nebulous phrase evoking the image of an idealized 1950s family slowly fading into gray. At best, it hints towards the long-term elements, stagnated wages, a statistical trend towards a lack of upward economic mobility, and generation shift downward. It's evidenced in omnipresent and omnivorous check-cashing storefronts, which offer broke people the opportunity to further break themselves at usury rates. Appliance rental companies that cause customers to pay more over time for essentials than they ever would have if they could manage good credit. And an arcane credit rating system that lowers scores drastically just for having small balance allotments or minor payment latenesses years before. I managed to get to the middle class and grab enough of a foothold to stay in it, not go on a forest of wood. I teach at a large university in Houston, and I'm fortunate to be one of the salaried professors here, as opposed to the freelance adjunct professors on campus, some of whom teach more classes than me and get paid far less, with none of my job's benefits. I drive home to my middle-class suburb through the poverty of the Third Ward, past people who are paying far more for many of the expenses of living, even though I make far more. It would be nice to sit in my car and think that the difference between my lifestyle and theirs was just down to hard work. But I'm under no such delusion. I'm where I am in part because of my mother's sacrifice, in part because I also had a white middle-class father a few miles away who was active in my life and invested in my education. I worked hard, sure, but nobody works harder to survive than poor people. I just got some good breaks, and so did many of my ancestors. A wealthy friend told me recently that this was an anti-rich moment in America. But I see Donald Trump on TV constantly bragging about the billions he says he has, and his crowd is cheering. I think most Americans love the rich, as long as they can convince themselves it's possible to join their ranks. But it's becoming increasingly obvious to even casual observers that there is no real right-angle triangle graph between our economic classes, with a slow and steady gradient to the top. We are separated by cliffs, incredibly easy to fall off, and with few handholds to climb. The vanishing middle class sounds cold, moderate, gradual, but it's not. For far too many, this economic reality is hot, violent, and now.
Matt Johnson is the author of the novels Loving Day and Pym. He's a professor in the University of Houston Creative Writing Program. Our next guest, Matt Ross, is a comic standout in the HBO series Silicon Valley. He plays Gavin Belson, the narcissistic and ruthless CEO of Hooli, a Google-like tech giant. Ross was scary in the HBO series Big Love, in which he played Albie Grant, the son of the leader of a polygamous cult group. Ross has written and directed a new film called Captain Fantastic, about a father who is so disillusioned with American capitalism and culture that he's gone off the grid with his six children in the woods of the Pacific Northwest. He looks and dresses like a 1960s hippie. The family car is a repainted old school bus named Steve. He homeschools his children and teaches them how to hunt and scavenge for food. He gives them daily instruction in meditation and survival skills, including extreme physical fitness training. He's also created a great books curriculum for them. His wife is hospitalized when the movie begins. When she dies, he and his children get on the bus and drive to the funeral, forcing them to function in the world they had dropped out of. Everyone's values end up being challenged. Let's start with a scene from early in the film. The father, played by Viggo Mortensen, is about to get on their bus, Steve, and drive into town so he can use a phone to check on his wife's condition. One of his daughters speaks first.
The training is over today. Can we take Steve somewhere for class later?
Maybe.
Why does Mommy have to be gone so long?
She hasn't been gone very long.
Actually, it's been 3 months, 2 weeks, 6 days, and 11 hours.
Mom is very ill.
Don't talk to us like we're your inferiors.
Beau is right. Mom needs to be in the hospital right now.
But you said hospitals are only a great place to go if you're a healthy person and you want to die.
You said Americans are undereducated and overmedicated.
You said the AMA are avaricious whores only tooling to spread their fat legs for Big Pharma.
All of those things are true, but Mom does not have enough of the neurotransmitter serotonin to conduct electrical signals in her brain.
Exactly when is Mom coming back?
That's what I'm going to go find out. Be good, monkey butts.
See you later, Dad. Bye.
Bye, guys.
Matt Ross, welcome to Fresh Air. I think we get a sense of how the father communicates with his children when he describes Mom doesn't have enough gabapentin for the neurotransmitters in her brain or whatever. Mm. How do you think the father, played by Viggo Mortensen, sees himself in your film?
I think he sees himself as trying not to be their friend, but their teacher. And I think, like all of us, he's doing the best he can and is trying to set a good example. He's challenging his children in a way that most of us don't. And for some people, that's shocking. For me, it's not. I think, you know, in the script, he says, I tell the truth to my children. I don't lie to my children. And I think that's probably the baseline for him.
He wants to be a free thinker, and he wants his children to be free thinkers. At the same time, he's kind of an authoritarian father. He maintains total control over their time, what they're exposed to, who they see, and they really don't see anyone, what they're allowed to eat. There's no other teachers or friends or friends' parents or television or movies.
Except for the mother.
Except for the mother, and she's in the hospital. So there's no outside source other than what's filtered through him. And it's such a paradox that I don't think he realizes that he's rebelling against authority, and he's created this authoritarian system that he controls.
Yeah, well, I think you're right. I think, well, a great deal of that is intentional. I mean, I think that he is, like hopefully all the characters in the film, complex and flawed. He is not the protagonist, and he's not the antagonist. At times, he is both, as are other characters.
So you have two children. Were you starting to question your own values as a father while you were making this movie, trying to examine your own motivations and everything?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think, you know, the genesis of it was precisely that. I have two kids. At some point, I was thinking a great deal about what my values are, what I wanted to pass to my children. I mean, all of us, anyone who has a child, you know, on some very primal, basic level, you want to protect them and prepare them to live lives as good global citizens, you know, as tolerant human beings and compassionate human beings, and you want to help prepare them for when they leave the nest. That's on a basic level. And then I think really when I retroactively look at what was going on in my own life, I think my wife and I were probably discussing and or arguing quite frequently about what our values were. And, you know, you're curating this human being's life. You are deciding everything, what they eat, what they read, what they watch, whether it's safe for them to walk down the street, you know, to go to the bookstore by themselves or the library or whatever, at whatever age. And for every family, it's different. And I had a lot of questions about what I wanted to pass on to my children. And I put them into the form of a narrative, really, asking those questions.
So I know that you spent some of your childhood living on communes with your mother, and I assume you drew something from that for this movie, because some of his values, some of his lifestyle is similar to what people wanted to do when they were creating like alternative communes in the 60s. Yeah. I'm always interested in the children who grew up on the communes and how they were shaped by it. So since I assume you're drawing on that in part for your movie, can I ask you a few questions about that?
Yeah, of course. So I'll correct you one thing, just so you know. Yes, my mother started or was part of starting various alternative living communities. I'm always very It's very important to me to make clear that they weren't hippie communes. I think that's an inaccurate term. It's a reductive term, but mainly it's an inaccurate term only because it was the 1980s and not the 60s, and these people were clearly not hippies. They tended to be artisans or artists or simply people who did not want to live in a urban environment. And some of them had families. Some of them were just by themselves or with a partner. Some of the homes had electricity and plumbing. Some did not. My memories are different than certainly what people think of as some kind of stereotypical hippie commune. You know, they were things like my brother and I walking for hours and hours with our bow and arrows through the forest. I mean, like 8 hours with our bows and arrows. And, you know, my memories are more just being out in nature. And I was not homeschooled. I went to public school. At one point, we lived something like 8 miles from a cement road and 35 or 40 minutes away from the general store, which was literally called the general store, and about an hour or and change from a town of 1,000 people. So we were very, very far in the forest. And I remember feeling very palpably that there were no other kids my own age that I was able to spend a lot of time with other than my brother, and feeling like, well, you know, when you're that age, you just want to go over to someone's house and forget, just watch TV or hang out. It was just that I wanted to just be in the presence of kids my own age. And that was true. And we also lived in a teepee. You know, at one point in the summer, we'd live in a teepee and go swimming in the pond. And
what always fascinates me about this kind of scenario is for the parents, it's an alternative. It's a kind of an idealized attempt at creating a life different from, outside of the mainstream. For a child growing up into it without the choice of whether they want to be there or not, it's not really an alternative because you don't know what it's an alternative to. Like, you haven't been exposed to mainstream culture, so you haven't chosen the alternative. And I'm not asking, I guess, whether it's fair or unfair to raise a child that way, but at what point did you realize that you were in this, what was supposed to be a more idealized, you know, more kind of utopian or whatever community, but that there was a world outside of that that you were not only cut off from, but you didn't know that much about?
Well, the truth is I wasn't born into that. I had lived in urban environments. By that time, I had lived in England. I had been to Africa.
Oh.
My parents were separated and divorced
okay.
when I was
You're really worldly.
Yeah, my parents were separated and divorced when I was quite young, and my mother wanted to start, I don't know if you're familiar with Waldorf schools there. There was an Austrian philosopher and theologian and educator named Rudolf Steiner, and you find these Waldorf schools. They tend to be in sort of progressive and upper middle class communities in the United States, but you find them all over the world. And she was interested in starting a Waldorf school in the United States, so we lived in England while she became accredited to do so. And by the time we'd been on some of these communes or, you know, alternative living situations, I'm not sure what the proper term would be, I had lived around the world. But to get to your point a little more, I think that she was a seeker of sorts. You know, look, the film is not about alternative living communities. That's sort of the backdrop for the beginning of the movie. I think if the movie is about anything, it's really about the choices we make as people, specifically as parents. But I remember, you know, my mother's choices were, she clearly wanted us to be connected to certain things that we would not be connected to if we lived in an urban environment. I remember we slaughtered goats that we would then eat, and she wanted us to see that. And we were pretty young, and those images are still in my head. I think if you ask her, she probably regrets. I think she'd say that we were too young to see that. But I think, you know, as I'm thinking about this, I think that her goal was to probably show us our food source, you know, say, look, you know, we eat certain things, but it's important to know where this comes from.
Let's talk a little bit about your role in Silicon Valley.
Sure.
Silicon Valley is an HBO comedy series about a struggling tech startup called Pied Piper. And you play Gavin Belson, the CEO of a tech giant, a Google-like company called Hooli. And before we really talk, I want to play a scene. So
sure.
Your character uses a lot of like feel-good, techie, optimistic jargon, but you're ruthless and totally lacking in empathy. You've created a unit called Nucleus, which is designed to compete with Pied Piper's data compression platform, a platform that would make it really fast and really easy to store massive amounts of data. But your unit, Nucleus, has been failing, and you're angry that Richard Hendricks, the young founder of Pied Piper, is doing a better job than Nucleus. So in this scene, your marketing people have just shown you a new ad, And it starts with a woman doctor examining a young girl. And then we see a happy girl, and we see two people shaking hands, all very inspirational. And along with these images, we see the words inspire, believe, imagine, innovate. So here's the scene that happens after we see the commercial.
And that is the very first spot in our new campaign, heralding the upcoming release of Nucleus this January at CES. Any questions?
I have a question. That was horrible.
I just got humiliated by a teenager at TechCrunch Disrupt, and you give me this tampon ad? A girl with diabetes on a swing.
I think she has cancer. Yeah. At least that's how I read it.
I don't care what kind of disease she had. All I care about is that Nucleus is better than Pied Piper. Hendrix just left us all in the dust. If we get this wrong, we could blow the business opportunity of a lifetime. Data creation is exploding. With all the selfies and useless files people refuse to delete on the cloud, 92% of the world's data was created in the last 2 years alone. At the current rate, the world's data storage capacity will be overtaken by next spring. It will be nothing short of a catastrophe. Data shortages, data rationing, data black markets. Someone's compression will save the world from Datageddon, and it sure as hell better be Nucleus and not Pied Piper. I don't know about you people, but I don't want to live in a world where someone else makes the world a better place, better than we do.
That last line became a famous line from Silicon Valley. I don't want to live in a world where someone else makes the world a better place, better than we do. What was your first reaction when you saw that line in your script?
Well, that line was actually, it's funny you're pinpointing that, because that line was actually something that Alec Berg just threw at me, that I don't believe that was in the script until we were shooting. And, you know, the writers, who are all phenomenal, I think they are, Mike Judge and Alec Berg and Clay Tarver and Dan O'Keefe, who I believe make up the major brain trust of the show. And there are other writers, of course, that I'm not mentioning. But Alec was either directing that episode, I don't remember, or he was there, as they are frequently, and if not every day. And he just came up and he was throwing me different lines, say this. And I remember just trying to get my mind around it, because it was, the construction of it was odd, and that's one of the reasons why it's so funny. But it was a great line, and I think when he was pitching it to me, I realized how fantastic it was.
So let's talk a little bit about your role in HBO's Big Love, and you played Albie. You're the son of a cult leader, and then become the leader of the cult. Can you compare for us playing a cultish kind of personality in the tech world playing that for comedy, and playing a cult leader in a very kind of threatening, serious way in Big Love?
Well, we don't know much about Gavin's personal life at all. I mean, I'm a secondary character in the show, and so I think I'm used as a force of antagonism largely, or some comedy. And that's not dissimilar in how Albie functioned in that drama as well. I was a force of antagonism, and sometimes the people in the compound were used for comedy. But Albie was
Albie is on Big Love.
Albie Grant, Albert Grant, otherwise known as Albie. He was homosexual in a world where that was absolutely verboten, obviously. It was a deeply religious community. And so he was closeted. He had many wives in this polygamous community, but he couldn't, his authentic self, his true self, could never be a public face. And so he was tortured in many respects. He was also, part of the narrative was that he had a very punishing, emotionally punishing father, played by Harry Dean Stanton, who never allowed him to be to have any kind of power or to have any voice in that community and or in his life. And so, you know, I always viewed Albie was very much he was such a broken man. He was he struggled, and his struggles were part of the narrative. So in terms of what I was allowed to do as an actor, there was, I would say, slightly more complexity that was allowed to come out, and certainly more vulnerability.
So we find out in the first season of Big Love that your character, Albie, is attracted to other men, which is so...
Which I didn't know, by the way.
That's what I wanted to ask you. When did you find out, and how did it change your impression of the character that you were playing?
I think I read it at the table read. I think the first scene where I was wondering about his sexuality was when he picks up a drifter or a hustler in a convenience store, and he takes him home. And that was just obviously a strange thing to do. I mean, why is he doing that? That was not clear. And his behavior that was written, the dialogue was very odd and very disconnected. And then when the hustler is finally saying, well, you know, are we having sex? What's going on here? It was scripted differently than how I ended up behaving. I think the script said that he howls like a wolf. And the director, I came to the director and said, I don't really know what that means. What if I do something completely different? What if, I mean, I think, you know, Albie has put it, this is he's confronted and he doesn't know what to do. And I think he's terrified. And what if he just starts slamming his head against the wall? And in a way, it sends the hustler from the room. The hustler's completely confused. And then you're not sure if that was some kind of, I don't know, psychotic break or if it was intentional. And we tried that. And we did it. And at the time, I remember thinking, well, I don't know if he's homosexual or if he's just the kind of person who's been so isolated that he puts himself in incredibly dangerous situations because he wants to feel something, that he's so numb, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. He feels nothing. And I thought, I actually, at that time, I remember thinking, well, maybe it's just that. And then the next season, I think I read a scene, and it could have been that same season, but I believe it was the next one where I read a scene where it said Albie he'd been arrested for doing something, and he was in a police station, and it said Albie is checking out all the butts of the cops that are there. And I was like, okay, if he's checking out their butts, then he's, you know, this is his sexuality. And that was the first inkling I had.
Matt Ross, thank you so much for coming on Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Matt Ross wrote and directed the new film Captain Fantastic. He co-stars in the HBO series Silicon Valley as Gavin Belson, the CEO of the tech giant Hooli. He spoke with Terry last Thursday. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Heidi Saman. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Teresa Madden, and Thea Challoner. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bianculli.